You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we look at the human urge to move about, to migrate, with a science writer who's been studying the topic. Now, eight counties in central and southwest Wisconsin are under a heat advisory today, with high temperatures in the 90s and the heat index nearing 100 degrees. It's one of the warmest days in what's been a long stretch of hot and humid weather for much of the state, and forecasts show that temperatures in the mid to high 80s at least are expected to continue for the rest of the week. Wisconsin's Emergency Management Department is warning people to watch for the signs of heat stroke and be super sure not to leave kids and pets in cars. You can check out their guidelines and advice. They're on Facebook as Ready Wisconsin. Jonathan Erdman is a Milwaukee-based senior digital meteorologist at weather.com. He's here to help us get a handle on this heat wave. John, welcome back to Central Time.
Rob, it's always a pleasure to be with you.
Well, I know 90-ish degrees in July, that in itself isn't that weird for Wisconsin. But this seems like an extended period of heat. Is it unusual, or am I just extra whiny this year?
No, it certainly has a Florida feel outside right now. I mean, I'm looking at a current map of dew points, which is kind of a measure of the moisture in the air. And generally, when the dew points are above 70, that's when it feels pretty humid. And I'm seeing dew points in parts of Wisconsin, 73, 74, even 76 degrees, which feels a lot like Florida in the summertime. So, we've had this stretch that started in late June, and it's kind of persisted through at least the first week of July. And unfortunately, there's more to come after that.
What's going on up in the sky that's making this hot weather, hot humid weather, settle in over us for such a long time?
So, Rob, heat waves are generally produced when you have these domes of high pressure aloft with sinking air. And when sinking air, when you have air that sinks, it dries out and it warms up. And it also diverts cool fronts away from the state. So we've had this general pattern where this dome of high pressure has sat over the Great Lakes. It's also extended well up into Canada. And it's just locked in this persistent phase of warmer than average weather since really the last weekend in June.
Now, you mentioned the dew point, and of course we have the temperatures and the heat index. Remind us, I think you've explained this to me before, how the heat index works.
Yeah, so the heat index is kind of summer's version of wind chill. So remember, wind chill is temperatures plus wind makes us feel colder. Well, heat index, it's temperatures plus humidity makes us feel hotter, makes it harder for the body to shed its heat through evaporation of sweat. So the warmer and the more humid it is, the higher the heat index. So when we have heat indices that are approaching 100 degrees, it makes it pretty difficult for the body to cool itself through sweat when you're outside in the middle of the day.
Talking to Jonathan Erdman, Milwaukee-based senior digital meteorologist at weather.com. We're talking about the weather, the hot and sustained weather we have going on. John, you already kind of spoiled the bad news for us. This is going to keep going for a while. What do we mean by a while?
Well, how about I give you a little bit of good news here?
Okay, so yeah, I like that.
So we are going to have a cool down coming just in time for the weekend. So by the time we get to Friday, we should see highs across the state generally in the 80s, not 90s. And that includes the southern part of the state. So we'll cool it down a little bit. And then by Sunday, we could have highs in the 70s in northern Wisconsin and the 80s in southern Wisconsin. So not terribly cool, but it'll definitely feel better than we've had. Unfortunately, once we get to about, say, the middle part of next week and beyond, that dome of high pressure is going to build back up into the Great Lakes. So we're going to get hot again by about mid to late next week with more 90s in store.
Hmm. And then this one may stick around for a while, too, if that dome builds up.
Yeah, it looks like it. Again, we'll get a break this weekend into maybe the first half of next week, and then that dome of high pressure will build back in. So we'll see more 90s. Particularly in southern Wisconsin, from about, say, Wednesday into the following weekend. And then we'll just have to see if that pattern can break after that, if we can actually get a cold front through. Now, if you're in northern Wisconsin, the back half of next week, we could see a lot of thunderstorms because you could get a stalled frontal boundary that could drape over the northern part of the state. So if you're headed up north, or if you're listening to us from up north, it might be kind of a noisy week next week as far as thunderstorms are concerned.
Yeah, let's talk about storms. It seems like there have been a bunch of, small but fairly intense storms. And depending on where you are, they either hit you or they miss you. What's been going on with storm activity during this hot patch?
Well, Rob, I could really vent about this because where I am in Waukesha County, I swear it's been a precipitation hole so far this year. I was watching the radar yesterday, and there was, you know, widespread rain and thunderstorms over much of, you know, the southern, basically the southeastern half of Wisconsin. We cut the state in half. The southeastern half was basically getting soaked. And I watched these storms come toward me, and they literally almost split around my neighborhood. And this can happen sometimes in the summer. You know, thunderstorms can be hit or miss. You know, they can, you hear the terms isolated and scattered. Well, those terms are descriptive of what thunderstorms can be. So, you know, you can drive 10 miles down the road and you see big puddles in the street, and you get back home and your grass could still look brown. So that can be the case at times during the summer months.
And one of the big severe weather worries in a Wisconsin summer, of course, is tornado activity. Are there prospects for that? What's the outlook over the next couple of weeks anyway?
Well, again, we'll keep an eye on, say, the middle to latter part of next week, particularly up in northern Wisconsin, for some severe thunderstorms, maybe with some damaging winds. You know, again, those details are to be determined. But in the meantime, with any rain that we get, we're getting to the time of year, and we saw this yesterday, where sometimes it's flash flooding that is the biggest concern, because sometimes these thunderstorms, especially if the jet stream is well to our north, just don't move very fast. So all of a sudden you can have a situation where you get this soaking rain and it just doesn't move. And all of a sudden you're seeing street flooding right outside your front door. So I think the severe threat doesn't look too bad over the next several days, but we'll have to keep an eye out for some damaging winds, maybe some flooding in parts of the state next week.
And so for the short-term prospect, we better get out and enjoy even the modest cool down this weekend, it sounds like.
Yeah, I think so. Sunday looks particularly nice, you know, with 70s in the north and 80s in the south. So, and there'll also be some lower humidity. So maybe we'll be able to give the air conditioning a rest, maybe open some windows at night and let some of that fresh air in. We should really take advantage of that. I have an air conditioning system that's about going on the fritz, so I really need to take advantage of things like that.
Well, John, good luck to you with getting some rain where you are, and good luck getting that AC to keep you going. Thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure, Rob.
Jonathan Erdman is a Milwaukee-based senior digital meteorologist at weather.com. He talked with us today about what's been causing our wave of hot and humid weather and when it might break. Again, you can find info from Wisconsin Emergency Management about staying cool and safe. They're on Facebook at Ready Wisconsin. Coming up, a rule change from the Trump administration could prevent foreign students from staying in the country if their college or university moves to completely online classes this fall. We'll learn how that could impact us here in Wisconsin coming up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, foreign students could be forced to leave the U.S. if college courses move online. We'll learn more about the rule and what it can mean for Wisconsin. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a writer's own food tradition.
Food can conjure up vivid memories of childhood. The tastes and smells can send us to another place while creating new memories in the moment. That's why writer Nancy Jorgensen has been thinking a lot about her German heritage and being raised on raw foods.
My cousins and I spit the last of our watermelon seeds into Nana's lawn and tumbled into the house. I was 10 years old, or maybe 6 or 12. In the kitchen, Nana leaned against the counter. She stroked my cheek with one hand and held a plate in the other, slaughtered beef, freshly ground and bloody red. Our parents circled an oak table. My uncles clutched Gettleman or Old Milwaukee and blew cigarette smoke. On the stove, pickles boiled in vinegar. The smoke and steam made my breath catch. Mother got up from the table, and in a few seconds, a knife rested in her hand. In front of her, a loaf of rye. On the counter, a shaker of salt. "Would you like some raw beef and onions?" I put out my hand. I was raised on this traditional German food, along with kraut from Nana's stoneware crock, and sausage from her hand-cranked meat grinder, oozed into animal intestine casings. We rarely ate in restaurants, our parents and grandparents creating meals from hand-tilled gardens, ancient grapevines, or a neighbor's Holstein. Now, my family often eats in restaurants. Last month, my husband Joel and I spent a week in Portland with our adult daughter, Gwen. One night in a local pub, she considered appetizers. On the menu, steak tartare. With a new name and extra ingredients, uncooked egg and capers, it was still Nana's raw beef and onions. We cook at home, too, and last week our older daughter Elizabeth prepared dinner for us. While we sipped Shiraz, she presented a tenderloin, crisp on the edges, but red and bleeding from the middle, just a few degrees past rare. Each bite, dipped in horseradish, stung my nose with a prickly ache. It took me back to Nana's garden, where that gnarly root grew among her beets and kohlrabi and turnips. I savored the burn. As Nana peeled carrots or cooked a warm potato salad dressing, she told me I was German and Pennsylvania Dutch. Her pride, like her red-checked tablecloth, underpinned every meal. It was clear my daughters inherited her German pedigree and taste for hearty dishes. A while back, Gwen, Elizabeth, Joel, and I spent 5 minutes spitting into tubes. When the results came back, Nana's genetics weren't as strong as I believed. My German DNA is less than 33%. I'm also 11% Scandinavian and 13% British. And Nana never mentioned over pork chops that I'm 8% Ashkenazi Jewish. I wonder what those ancestors would say about our habits with uncooked meat and milk from the neighbor's cow. Before the holidays this year, we planned our Christmas menu. Gwen chose pickled herring, popular with German fishermen. Elizabeth requested pretzels, a German baking tradition. And I made German apple pie. But then I whipped a pint of cream, a British birthright, and dropped meatballs in gravy, definitely Danish. We included a Mediterranean salad, Asian egg rolls, and southern pecan pie. Surveying the dishes, I realized our German heritage a muted presence. But our Wisconsin ties shouted. Piper porch wine, raised grain beer, Wisconsin-produced milk. From our own garden, pickled cucumbers, heirloom tomatoes, Duchess apples. A bounty of food and tradition, as wide as the world and as narrow as Wisconsin.
Nancy Jorgensen is a writer based in Waukesha, and her story is part of a project from Wisconsin Life called Food Traditions. It's a multimedia exploration of food, culture, and identity, and can be found at wisconsinlife.org/foodtraditions. And we want to hear about your own food traditions. Share them with us on Instagram. Just search for Wisconsin Life. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency announced on Monday that international students with certain visas would not be able to stay in the country or return if they were already abroad if their college campus moved all fall classes online. Colleges and universities across the country made the switch to virtual classrooms in the spring as the COVID-19 pandemic picked up steam in the United States. Our next guest has been following the story and joins us to talk about how schools in Wisconsin could be impacted by this new rule from ICE. Rich Kramer is a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio based in Eau Claire. Rich, welcome back to Central Time.
Glad to be back. Thanks, Rob.
Well, Rich, tell us a little more about what this rule from the Student and Exchange Visitor Program, part of ICE, would do. What change would it make?
So this is for international students that use the technical terms are F1 and M1 visas. So that allows them to study in the country. But, you know, historically, the visas did not allow students to take full online loads. What happened was in the spring when all the universities basically on a dime moved classes online, they issued an exemption from the normal rules that were for the spring and summer semesters. Then, you know, all of a sudden this week we heard that they were going to get rid of that exemption. So for, you know, I've seen figures that there's more than a million foreign exchange students in colleges and universities around the U.S., that leaves them in a strange predicament of kind of an unusual place where if their colleges happen to be moving entirely online, that their visas are no longer good, that they can still take the classes online, but they can't do it while living in the United States. So, you know, in Wisconsin, just the UW system alone, you know, there's thousands and thousands of international students as of 2019. So it could have some, you know, a pretty big impact for the universities and for those individuals, of course.
Now, we're seeing really from day to day, Rich, universities and colleges around the country just now announcing their plans for whether they're going to have in-person classes or virtual or some combo. Do we have answers to that? Do we know what, say, UW System is planning, for example, in the fall?
Well, the phrase I keep hearing from UW campuses is hybrid model. So in order to reduce the numbers of people in the classroom to kind of accommodate the social distancing requirements, they're talking about having maybe half the class study one day online and then the other half is in person. And then they swap them out. You know, if it's a Tuesday, Thursday class, one is online, one day is in person. So they're all really trying to figure out ways to make this work. The big push has been to have some sort of in-person classes because the administrators say that students have been asking for that, you know, although I haven't seen any official like surveys or, you know, studies, but anecdotally they say that that's what students want. But the problem is, you know, we're seeing large increases in the percentage of new positives happening in places like Madison, right around the college, actually. And even in Eau Claire, I looked at some data provided by the State Department of Health Services, and in the neighborhood that has a lot of college students, there seems to be a higher percentage of positives than elsewhere in the city, which I guess is to be expected because you've got large groups of people, you know, gathering in those locations. So it's really this just kind of ratchets up the pressure on the universities to have it be at least somewhat in person. And if not, I mean, if they're moving classes online, that's a big revenue stream, international students, because again, in Wisconsin, over the past 8 years, four-year universities have not been allowed to increase tuition on students from inside the state, undergraduate students. So they've been increasing tuition for out-of-state and international students.
What have you heard from officials at the UW system or at campuses around the state?
Well, it was really, I was not successful in getting an actual interview with any administrator yesterday at UW campuses. I tried Marquette University too. You know, typically what I see is when something like this comes out from the federal government, everyone really spends some time thinking about it. And then if statements do come out, they're pretty carefully worded. The University of Wisconsin System spokesman Mark Pitch said, you know, he was highlighting that students come from all around the world to attend University of Wisconsin System campuses. He says, we welcome them. These students provide a great benefit for our universities, and anything that makes it harder for them to attend will raise a host of issues. So clearly, you know, a statement that seems to be against the decision by ICE, but it's not, you know, it's not super forceful. Chancellor Rebecca Blank at UW-Madison basically said the same thing. She said that the campus was committing to a hybrid model that they believe would allow international students to stay, you know, in the country. But she also mentioned that since the start of the pandemic, international students have faced all kinds of difficulties and hardships, including, you know, travel restrictions. Their consulates have been closed. And also in incidences of xenophobia, hate and bias. That's what Blank said in her statement. But it's been difficult to really get some nuanced statements from campus leaders.
Talking to Rich Kramer, WPR reporter, looking at new guidelines from ICE saying that if campuses decide to go full virtual, many international students couldn't stay in the country to do their studies. Rich, Governor Evers touched on this, I gather, at his briefing yesterday on COVID-related issues. What's coming from the governor?
Yeah, I'm not sure if he was expecting a question on this or not, but Governor Evers also seemed, you know, he said it would be a bad idea. It's a huge mistake, he said, to do this to students, you know, international students who might, through no fault of their own, might be attending or registered for a class at a university that decides to go online. So he said it would be a huge mistake. What we have seen in, you know, Harvard University made some big news because they announced that they were going to be completely online. And this announcement from ICE came not long after that. So Harvard and MIT have filed a lawsuit to try to block this. And they're suing on pretty specific grounds. Basically, they're arguing that that Immigration and Customs Enforcement didn't go about initiating this rule the right way, that these types of rules require a 30-day notice and, you know, public notice and comment periods. That didn't happen. This was just announced in a press release, in effect. So I haven't seen any court action. I don't know if that'll lead to a stay that would block this rule. There's just so much that is unknown at this point.
So what are you watching for in our last minute, Rich, to get some clarification on what's going to happen next?
Well, I mean, I'll be watching the courts. If this lawsuit ends up blocking the rule, you know, you'll see a battle between the federal government and these universities that are suing them. And in the meantime, it'll be interesting to see how universities that were planning to be online completely will, they might hedge their bets by creating, you know, plans to offer in person, but it's just a wild curveball. And also this rule creates a lot of paperwork for universities too, at a time when they're trying to deal with new Title IX sexual assault, sexual harassment rules coming from the federal government. And meanwhile, they're dealing with quite a bit having to do with COVID-19 and fall reopening. So I can't even tell you what I'm going to be focusing on. Every day it's different.
Rich, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That's WPR reporter Rich Kramer. He's based in Eau Claire. He joined us for a look at the impact of an ICE rule that would require international students to leave the country if their campus goes completely virtual. As Rich mentioned, Harvard and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology have filed a lawsuit in federal court challenging that rule. Coming up, our next guest argues migration is part of human nature and has some lessons from the past to help us think about the next great migration in our future. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show, the economic damage from the COVID-19 pandemic is raising the risk of evictions for people in Wisconsin and around the country. Kate Archer-Kent talks to an eviction lawyer. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, international migration is often treated as a problem, a threat even, to international order and national security. But our next guest says the human species is one of many in nature that has relied on migration as a method of survival. And in an era of climate change, migration may be a big part of our survival toolkit for humans and other species as well. In her new book, she looks at the history and biology behind immigration and shares stories of people caught up in an increasingly difficult migration landscape. Sonia Shaw is author of the books Pandemic and The Fever. Her latest is called The Next Great Migration, The Beauty and Terror of Life on the Move. Sonia, welcome to Central Time.
Nice to be here.
Well, you look back at our development as a species, as humans. How big a role did migration play?
Well, I think what we're learning now, just in really recent years, is that migration was not the intermittent, exceptional kind of phenomenon that we've long thought of it as, but really central to our own history as humans, but also really central in nature, you know, for a lot of wildlife as well. So migration has moved, I think, from the margins to really the middle of, you know, our understanding of how the biology and how the ecosystems of the world function.
But you say in intellectual history, there was this change where we started to view ourselves as, you know, distinct groups of people rooted to distinct places, somehow even carrying that with us when we would move to a new place. Why did we develop this mindset that the norm is to be rooted in one place?
Yeah, it's interesting. I tried to trace that back. And the moment I trace it back to is when Carl Linnaeus, the Swedish naturalist, set out the taxonomy of the world that you know, modern biologists still use to this day. And he basically decided where everything belonged. And for him, you know, different wild species belonged exactly where he found them. Different peoples who lived on different continents, they belonged in those places too. So he had a kind of picture of nature that was very still. Everything was in a certain place where God had put it, and that's where it had always been, because, you know, nature was an expression of God's perfection for him. And he's considered today the father of modern taxonomy. So the way he categorized and classified all of the species has been very much incorporated into not just how we study nature, but also how we think of it.
And you see the same patterns in non-human species of plants and animals as we see in humans. Can you talk about the importance of migration as a way for creatures to adapt, contrary to that idea that we had this fixed set of species in fixed places?
Yeah, so we teach our kids that idea from the very youngest ages with our, you know, our animal maps, where the camel stands in for the Middle East and the kangaroo stands in for Australia and the, you know, bear stands in for North America, et cetera, et cetera. It's this whole idea of animals being from certain places where they belong. But what scientists are learning in just the last handful of years through new technology like GPS and solar power, you can actually tag animals and track their movements continuously over their lifetime, regardless of where they go. That's something new that has only recently been possible. And what scientists are learning is that all of these creatures move way more than anyone ever thought. They don't stay in their nice little defined niches and habitats that we've kind of contained them in. They track animals in parks, that parks have been built for them, you know, and we protected these nice parks and reserves, and they're moving way beyond those. You know, giraffes are moving, you know, they're spending most of their time outside of the reserves we have created for them. Turtles swimming way beyond the boundaries of marine protected zones. Elephants, who are thought to range only in one country, are wandering across many countries. So we're just seeing this picture of movement that's far greater in scale, in pace, in complexity than we have thought in the past.
We're talking to science writer Sonia Shaw about her new book, The Next Great Migration, The Beauty and Terror of Life on the Move. Let's get into that concept now, The Next Great Migration. What are you talking about there?
Well, one thing that we're starting to understand about what migration is that it's a response to environmental change. It's a way to adapt and be resilient to those changes. So right now, of course, we're living in this period of massive change because of the, you know, climate change. And we're already seeing around 80% of wild species are moving into new places in sync with the shifting climate. And that's not just, you know, a cod, you know, like fish in the sea. Obviously, they can move pretty fast. They've shifted more than 200 kilometers a decade towards the poles, and terrestrial animals are moving up into the heights. Frogs and fungi in the Andes have climbed 400 meters over the past 70 years. But it's not only the kind of mobile species we think of. Everything's on the move. Coral reefs are moving. Forests are moving. Coral polyps around Japan have been tracked since the 1930s. And they've been moving 14 kilometers north every year. Forests in the Himalayas have been climbing uphill around 20 meters every decade. So you just see this picture, all these creatures are really trying to move in shift with, in sync with the shifting climate.
And you look a lot at barriers to movement for humans and other species. Sometimes those are natural barriers, a desert, say, or an ocean. But you look a lot at human-created barriers. Let's first of all look at how humans have carved up the world in ways that make it difficult for, say, animal species to move around, to have successful breeding populations in as wide an area as they need to.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at migration in animals and there are shifting ranges, one of the biggest barriers is that they have to move through all of our stuff. You know, our cities, our towns, our mines, our farms, our industrial activities have swallowed up over half of the terrestrial surface of the planet. So wild species that are trying to move, you know, make these really life-saving movements into new places, they get caught in, you know, killed on highways or distracted by lights or, you know, any number of different ways in which our infrastructure prevents them from moving. And there's actually been really good correlations between the ability of an animal to move and the human footprint in a certain landscape. So what a lot of conservationists are thinking about doing now is instead of creating more parks to conserve, you know, fixed areas, what we need to do is protect bridges and corridors so that wildlife can actually move into the places where they're going to be able to survive better.
And then when it comes to human migration, and this ends up being a controversial issue, a huge issue in American politics these days, you write that we've seen in the last few decades a hardening of borders, where once upon a time, a lot of boundaries between groups of people or countries were a little more fuzzy. We are really delineating those and stopping movement through those. Can you talk about that global trend?
Yeah, we have more walls and fences on international borders today than at any time in the past. So we're really living in this moment where we need to move more than anything, you know, more than any time in the past, and yet we're making it harder for people to do that. But what, you know, the kind of flip side of that is, you know, people are moving. We have more people living outside of the countries of their birth than ever before. We have more people who are displaced from their home today than at any time since the Second World War. And organizations like the International Organization on Migration, which is a UN agency, predicts that 200 million or more people may need to move in coming decades as the climate changes. So those movements, if we think of them as negative and as solely disruptive, then I think the political response is pull up the ladders, you know, close the gates, don't let them in. They're going to inundate us. But if we start to understand migration in a new way, that these movements are actually not the crisis. The movements are maybe the result of a crisis, the climate crisis or other crises, but the movements themselves are part of the solution. It's part of how we adapt to all these changes. And I think, you know, that's kind of the direction I'm trying to, the argument I'm trying to build in the book is like, let's look at this in a different light, where migration isn't catastrophic. You know, migration is actually the solution to the problems we're facing.
I want to spend some time on that in a couple of minutes, but I also want to zoom in here. You spend a lot of time in your book talking about refugees you've met, that you've worked with in some cases. Can you talk about what you learned from, you know, not the statistics and not the big picture, but from the actual people who have, in often desperate situations, moved as a survival mechanism?
Well, this is what kind of started the journey that became this book for me. Was I wrote a book called Pandemic a few years ago that came out in 2016, and by the time it was over, the quote unquote migrant crisis in the Mediterranean had started up, and it was just grabbing all the headlines. You know, these people from Syria and Afghanistan trying to get into Europe, and they're drowning in the Mediterranean Sea and getting, you know, stuck on these rickety vessels and things like that. And I went there to try to understand how this might be disruptive to public health and to all these other things that I've been looking at for a long time. And what I found, when I was finally there, is that, you know, these people were not carrying disease and disruption, which is what I had thought. You know, I had come there to say, oh, there's going to be outbreaks of disease and things like that. It was just the opposite. That what I found is that people on the move in general are healthier than the host populations they enter. And that's actually a documented effect called the healthy migrant effect. Migrants have better health outcomes. They have less obesity. They have, you know, they have what's called portable capital, right? Like they don't have property perhaps, and they don't have titles, but they have good health. They have skills. They have education. They have social contacts. They have resilience, all these things, because you need them to move. So the whole way we kind of characterize migrants and refugees and asylum seekers and all these people on the move who we have shut out and marginalized in the way we think about them, and also in our policies, is absolutely backwards. You know, these people, the people I met when I was there were, you know, and this is just so trite and obvious to say, but they were incredibly resilient. They're resourceful people. These are people who are journalists or scientists or teachers. These are the people I found in the refugee camps in Greece stuck, you know, they had walked there with their families from Afghanistan and Syria. So our whole mindset about migration is what I wanted to interrogate in this book. And as I did it, I found that so many of our reflexive ideas about migrants are absolutely backwards.
We're talking to science writer Sonia Shah about her new book, The Next Great Migration, The Beauty and Terror of Life on the Move. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you or your family moved around over the years within national borders or beyond? Do you think we need to have tough border policies, or do you think we should be more welcoming to immigrants? Call in with your thoughts and your questions for our guest about her book at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the science and history of migration with science writer Sonia Shah. Her newest book is The Next Great Migration, The Beauty and Terror of Life on the Move. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a migrant, an immigrant to the United States or from within the United States? Love to hear the story of why you or your parents or grandparents moved. Do you work with or live around immigrants? What's been the experience getting to know them, seeing them in your workspace or community? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Sonia, when, you know, you've got one group of people who have been living in a place for a couple few generations or more, and there is a noticeable change, a group of new people coming from out of state, out of country, whatever. Is there a way to make that a positive experience, that change, given the change, any kind of change can be hard for people?
And there's no doubt that changes are disruptive. You know, any kind of change is disruptive. There's a loss, and but there's also gains, right? So I think the problem we have with our conversation around migration is that we only look at a very small slice of it. So we look at, say, asylum seekers, or we look at refugees, or we look at long-distance international migrants who are coming into our particular community. What we're not seeing is the huge ocean of migration that's happening beneath our notice without causing problems, that, you know, people are moving all the time. And not just right now, but also in our past. You know, we think of our past as having this punctuated by, you know, kind of anomalous migration. So the migration out of Africa, that was one. And then the modern era of migration that began when we started being able to, you know, have steamships and planes and things like that. But what we now understand is that we have not been migrants as an exceptional experience. It's been continuous. You know, scientists are putting together our migratory past through ancient DNA. This is only just happening last few years. And what they're learning is that we were moving all along. So it's not something that we do as, it's not a rare thing. It's not exceptional. It's not disruptive. It's really been continuous. People walked out of Africa into the Americas. They went back into Europe. They went into Asia. They, you know, they didn't stay put. We had multiple waves of humans migrating into places like the Tibetan Plateau, out into the most remote islands of the Pacific. We did it again and again. We didn't do it because we were desperate. We didn't do it because of catastrophe. We didn't do it because we ran out of food or land or, you know, any of the other things that was still present in Africa where we started out. We moved anyway. So it's really played such a huge role in our own path. So I think when we talk about, well, aren't these newcomers kind of disruptive? Yeah, sure, they are. But let's look at the bigger picture, the context of all the movement that's happening, the people who are moving all the time, continuously, who we are not noticing because they integrate, because they assimilate, because they're moving within borders, perhaps, because they're moving from neighboring countries that we don't mind, you know, that we're not paying attention to. So if you look at the disruptions that we're talking about, you know, in any specific case, in this broader context, I think the pros and cons kind of, you know, work out differently.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Karen is with us in Watertown. Karen, hello.
Hi. I've been listening to this, and I also have been thinking about this topic for a while. And I think I'm more speaking about the last 400 years and more the United States than other countries. But it seems to me that the people who migrate come from money. They have the resources. Because they have the resources, they're educated, and they make a better way in the United States or perhaps other countries. I'm not quite as national about this question as I thought I was going to be, because I also think that people who don't have money sometimes have more, oh, for lack of a better word, gumption and willingness to work hard no matter what to get to a better place. Not necessarily.
I got you, Karen. I'm going to jump in because we just have a few minutes left. Sonia, that was, I think she's hitting that idea of the portable capital you were talking about that often people who move bring with them.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, it's not the poorest of the poor, you know, what we see in international migration. It's not the poorest of the poor who are able to move. So the people who are able to move are people who have a lot of the kinds of things that are considered really the bedrock, you know, qualities that you need in building sort of the middle class, right? Resourcefulness, education, skills, good health.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Sonia Shaw, author of the new book, The Next Great Migration. Back to your calls. Enos is with us now in Madison. Enos, hello.
Yes, hello.
What did you want to tell us about?
So I'm from Germany originally. I came here in my early 20s. And, it was hard to move, you know, and I wanted to just like, I thought it was very interesting, the idea of, that people that move are resilient. And you know what, that is probably very true, because you know, change. For a person to change, and even if that's just change of location, I mean that it takes a lot. And I just also the idea of that, if you're, you know, coming to a place where people are like, you know, locked in their home sweet home mentality. And we've been doing this for 100 years, and this is how we're going to do it. Well, sometimes change.
Enos, thanks a lot for the call. And Sonia, I know this is a personal story for you. This is connected to your own family's story. Could you connect with Enos a little bit about making that transition to the new place from your own family's history?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my parents were immigrants from India. They settled in the U.S. a few years before I was born. So that act of international migration became central in their lives, but it also became central in my life because it made me feel like out of place. You know, it wasn't until I started putting this book together that I realized, like, if you have a migratory past, that is actually, you know, the normal thing. Like, that is actually in the larger scale of human history and human experience, like being a migrant or being a recent migrant, that's central. You know, what's really kind of more unusual, perhaps, is staying still. So, you know, I think the other thing that I'd like to make is that, yes, it does take a lot of resilience to move into new places. And that's why immigrants have the kind of status that we see with, you know, education and health and all of that. But at the same time, like, we all are built to move. You know, our bodies are very adaptable. There's really interesting studies being done as far back as the early 20th century that showed that immigrants' children, and immigrants themselves, their bodies would literally start to change as soon as they started moving into a new place. You know, so they would measure all these, you know, they take your measurements of your limbs and all your bodily measurements. This was a thing that was common in the 1920s and 30s. And they found that immigrants changed. Our bodies literally shapeshift depending on where we go. And what this tells me is that we are built for migration. Our bodies are good at it.
We'll leave it there. Sonia, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's science writer Sonia Shaw. We talked to her today about her new book. It's called The Next Great Migration, The Beauty and Terror of Life on the Move. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, the school year is just weeks away with a lot of open questions about how, when, even if schools can reopen safely. A Wisconsin pediatrician joins the show for a look at some of the latest national guidelines, and you can share your thoughts. A lot of big companies have dropped ads on Facebook calling for the social media giant to do more to stop hate speech. A social media expert gives us the latest, and you, again, can join in with your reactions. And a guest makes the case that American workers have gotten fleeced over the last 3 decades, but there's a chance the COVID crisis could start to change things. That and more, all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 8, Kate gets two different Republican perspectives for and against the re-election of President Trump. That's tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll hear about the all-in campus democracy challenge and the effort to get college students in Wisconsin involved in politics. A little bit of competition involved along the way. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.